Here are some announcements of events that you can join in to help change the world. First of all, I'll remind you that today until 5 p.m., this year's annual BAE Vigil will be happening on the sidewalk in front of BAE corporate headquarters on Spitbrook Road in Nashua. It's exit 1 off of Route 3. Also, we've gotten word that Bill Moyers is going to sign off as host with a report on the Republican media machine. On Friday, December 17th at 9 p.m. on PBS, Bill Moyers signs off as host and managing editor of PBS's weekly news magazine, Now with Bill Moyers. After three seasons at the helm, by continuing Now's ongoing coverage of the impact of media consolidation on democracy. The program looks inside the Republican media machine that the conservative New York Times columnist David Brooks called a dazzling, efficient ideology delivery system, and examines how conservatives exploited the demise of the fairness doctrine to produce a vast echo chamber that is admittedly partisan and powerfully successful. Now we'll continue its hard-hitting journalism and thoughtful analysis on January 7th with veteran journalist and current co-host David Brancaccio as its new host in 2005. The following day in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, there's going to be a Giving the Gift of Peace march and a Support Your Local Activists holiday market. It's sponsored by Seacoast Peace Response, and you're asked to join in to bring the message of peace to the forefront of the holiday season. From 11:30 to 1:30 at the UU Church's Carnon House, which is at 206 Court Street, just behind the church, there will be a holiday market featuring books, buttons, bumper stickers, peace calendars, videos, cards, etc. And at the same time, a poster and craft-making session for the march, also in the Carnon House. 2 p.m., the march will be happening in Portsmouth. Meet in Market Square to begin. Also on December 18th, New Hampshire Peace Action and members of New Hampshire Veterans for Peace and local peace and justice groups, such as Seacoast Peace Response, have declared a New Hampshire statewide day of action against the Iraq War. New Hampshire Peace Action is creating holiday cards to give to people as a handout, which will give information on the war and occupation of Iraq, military spending, and the humanitarian crisis in Iraq, as well as what ordinary citizens can do. For more information, contact David at ddiam@ttlc.net or 603-749-9159. Looking farther ahead, Tuesday, January 4th at 7 p.m., Seacoast Peace Response's speaker series continues with a screening of New Hampshire filmmaker Tom Jackson's newest video called Worlds Apart, 9/11 First Responders Against War. The documentary features footage from a peacemaking delegation that brought 9/11 EMT Megan Bartlett and producer Tom Jackson to Afghanistan in May 2004. That will be happening at the UU Church in Portsmouth. And for more info, go to Seacoast Peace Response's website, www.seacoastpeacerespons.org. Also, on January 20th, Thursday, please join many, many people in the counter-inaugural anti-war protest and rally in Washington, D.C. Protesters will be lining the streets of the presidential motorcade route. There are going to be buses leaving from New Hampshire for this. To find out about that, contact Jamila at jamilla@wellinformed.org or 207-439-5800. Even farther ahead, but something to think about now, there's going to be a delegation from Witness for Peace and the World Fellowship Center to Cuba to attend the Fourth Hemispheric Encounter in Struggle Against the FTAA, Free Trade Area of the Americas. Join 1,000-plus activists from throughout the Americas. Get inspired, educate yourself, strategize to affect trade policy, and experience revolutionary Cuba without a media filter. For more info on that, Andy at worldfellowship.org or 603-447-2280. The application deadline is February 28th for that. We're now going to continue our election fraud violation coverage. First, I want to let you know that this weekend, December 10th through 13th, is a nationwide protest election violations day. Defend the recounts and demand election reform. The nearest one to us that we have heard of is in Boston at the bandstand on the Boston Common. It'll be from noon to 2. And will be a protest against the stolen election in the last day before the Electoral College is supposed to vote, which is happening on Monday. Now let's hear more about investigating the 2004 election. This clip is of Bev Harris from Black Box Voting, interviewed on American Dream Radio.
I'm Jerry Krantman, and this is American Dream Radio. If you look around, it seems that the 2004 presidential elections are over and done with. Ask anyone. George W. Bush was elected to a second term, to the horror of some and the delight of others. Ohio is going to have a recount, though. If the results change, John Kerry could still theoretically become the president. Still, candidate Kerry and the Democratic Party seem strangely reluctant to really push for a fair recount, but have offered some support to those who are pushing for one. When the talking heads of corporate news mention this activity at all, it is to dismiss the chances of a reversal in Ohio as insignificant, and perhaps they are right. But mostly, corporate news sources are silent on the matter, and have turned Americans' tongues to clucking about other people's elections. Don't those Ukrainians know what it means to fight for democracy? So many of us watch their struggle and feel glad that our system works so well. The American people, undisturbed by the shocking testimony from Ohio voters, seem largely willing to follow along and put the elections behind them, and watch democracy on television. In the Ukraine, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan, we watch others do the democracy thing, but we're not showing much interest in doing the hard work of being vigilant about democracy in this country. In the absence of any information, Americans really have to seek it out if they hope to hear the voices of a threatened democracy here at home. Corporate news is ignoring the sworn testimony so many Americans go back to their football games and tell themselves that it's just a few un-American hippie dissidents causing all the trouble. Democracy is fine. With more politically aware friends, the words voter suppression are being uttered in frank, intimate discussions, usually with a shrug. What can you do? Fortunately for U.S. democracy, the 2004 election isn't over for everyone. The Green Party and Libertarian Party have joined together and raised enough money to pay the required recount fee and are forcing the votes to be recounted in Ohio, a recount that could possibly change the outcome of the presidential election. Others are trying to get Kenneth Blackwell, Ohio's Secretary of State, to recuse himself from the recount, that is, to stand aside and let the fairness of the recount be assured by someone other than the chairman of the Bush campaign in Ohio, Kenneth Blackwell. Meanwhile, speculation is that the Democrats are lying low so they won't risk being branded as sore losers in the 2006 elections and beyond. On December 9th, 2004, I spoke with Bev Harris, the executive director of blackboxvoting.org, and a nationally recognized expert on the subject of electronic voting and fair elections. She is also the author of the book Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. Ms. Harris and blackboxvoting.org are very involved in the still ongoing investigations into voting irregularities in the 2004 elections in Florida, Ohio, and elsewhere. In this 55-minute interview, Bev Harris talked about the post-election struggle to get the facts. Learn more about American Dream Radio on the web at americandreamradio.org. Bev Harris, welcome to American Dream Radio. So how about those voting machines? I've been paying attention to the news, and there's hardly a word about them. They must have worked out great. Were you surprised?
Well, the truth is nobody knows how they worked out, except that in some places they definitely didn't work out great, because nobody has really done the checks and balances and the audits to find out. I shouldn't say nobody. There are some really excellent citizens who have gone out there and done their homework, and there's no question that the machines are not performing adequately. For example, in Pinellas County, Florida, the machines flipped the vote. They had the exact, you know, everything that was yes was no, and everything that was no was yes for a proposition. And you know how they always do this thing. They always come back and say, it was a glitch. Well, that's not a good enough answer at this point. Flipping an election is a serious thing. When we finished with Florida, we came up with at least four counties that really, really need intensive action and probably need to have their management replaced. Because, you see, elections in the United States, even though there may be something that's more systemic that can happen on a national level, such as a weakness in remote access to a particular vendor's system, they basically break down at a county level. If you've got really good county officials who understand the real risk points with their software, which is a rare thing, actually, you can have good ones that don't understand it, well, then you're in good shape. But some of the officials that we are meeting, and particularly some of the ones in Florida, really need to be replaced. They're just not working in the interest of the public. They're quite arrogant, and they look at their little voting system as, or their elections office as, their little private domain, and they don't seem to think it's anyone's business to know what they're doing back there. These problems surfaced in many different locations in the country, but they are only caught when you have very vigilant citizens who are very much involved in it. There is a citizens group in Pinellas County, Florida, that is very aggressive, smart, self-directed. It's got an excellent computer programmer who's involved in it. And so basically the fact that it was caught was more because there happened to be a citizens group watching.
So having people there made the difference to even knowing something was going on.
Because they were going over all of the numbers and saying, hey, this doesn't make sense.
Let me perhaps, just by way of background, ask what black box voting is. What are we talking about there?
Black box voting is a consumer protection group for elections. It's blackboxvoting.org, actually. And it is designed to make sure that we have elections that represent, first of all, that everybody can vote in, that's eligible to vote, and that represent the vote that you actually cast, make sure it's counted correctly.
Where did that name come from?
It came from, I interviewed a gentleman by the name of Arnold Erkin, professor. He's at Stevens Institute. He started the very first testing lab for voting machines. And he said that there are two types of testing. There's black box testing and there's white box testing. Black box testing is where you don't really look inside the machine. You just run a few ballots through, and if it counts right, you know, you figure it's good. White box testing is where you actually go in and examine the source code. Well, when he started this testing lab, the voting machine vendors would not let him do the white box testing, and he refused then. He actually shut his lab down. He refused to do it because he said, if all I can do is black box testing, we don't really know what's going on in these voting machines. I won't put my name on it. So that's why they're black box voting machines.
I see. Okay, and you're trying to eliminate black box type voting machines?
Well, we're trying to make them auditable. And they certainly should not be black box. They should be white box if they're going to be used at all, meaning that they should be completely open source and available for very thorough examination of the source code and so forth. in addition to, they should certainly be transparent and able to be audited. Transparent doesn't mean plexiglass. It means that every step of the way, citizens can monitor the process in a meaningful way.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that the computer voting is faster and ostensibly more accurate, you're saying that we probably can't rely on the skilled professionals writing voting software for us. The companies that are in the business of making ATM machines and other equipment that we rely on every day.
Two things with that. One is they're not actually faster. We're finding out that the more bells and whistles they have and the greater they're supposed to be, they seem to be slower. And the newer models are actually slower than the older models, which is quite interesting. And the other thing is they aren't necessarily designed by experts in computer science. In fact, one of the people who was a senior programmer for the Diebold system was a 23-count embezzler who had done 4 years in prison. We obtained his Department of Corrections documents, and he specialized in computer fraud. Now, he may have been an expert, but he's not the type of expert we want.
I see. Well, I think I had read, perhaps on your site, that there are that he's not the only felon in these groups.
No, that's true. Unfortunately, they have a long and colorful history. We'll just put it that way.
Mm-hmm. I guess you know. I was trying to lead back to what you were saying about the black box, and once these companies develop this software, don't they have an obligation to their shareholders to keep it secret? To make it a trade secret, to copyright it, patent it?
Well, you see, if you patent something, you don't need to keep it a secret. And so that is something that they might want to do, is patent it and then make it completely open and above board so everyone can see it. They've decided not to patent it. A patent, of course, you register it, and it's your design is locked in so that such that other people cannot copy it without violating the patent. What they've decided to do is not patent it, but keep it as a proprietary trade secret, sort of like the formula to Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. Well, in a situation that is a public trust, like voting, that is just not appropriate.
If other people could see their source code, would that not make it less secure?
No, not necessarily.
I mean, could hackers find their way in?
Opening up the source code is not the wonderful panacea that everyone thinks it is anyway. It would be more secure than what it is now, because right now we have people that we don't even know from, we don't even know where, whose credentials we have no idea, a small handful of them writing something that we can't see. That's certainly not the way to run an election. Mm. However, a lot of people believe in the open source. It's not a bad idea, but it's not going to solve everything, because the solution is more complicated than that. For one thing, you could have open source code published on wherever it is and then go stick something else in a voting machine.
Uh-huh.
You see, there's ways that people can get around that have to do with plain old grease in the palms, you know, going ahead and paying somebody off.
Well, surely these voting machines are special equipment that's being manufactured that only runs this particular kind of software, or that would be things that people wouldn't ordinarily...
Oh, no. In fact, the central tabulators work on just a regular PC, and they run on Windows. In fact, I've got the central tabulator software on both of my PCs.
Uh-huh.
I went ahead and found the Diebold software and also the Sequoia software, and I've got it installed on my computer so I can show and demonstrate it to people.
Well, then this proprietary software must be hard to hack, because they must have tight security if they're using just a common Windows interface.
Well, what they actually did in Diebold's case was they disabled the security for remote access, which is quite a concern. They put the remote access in. Well, Windows comes with remote access, meaning someone can get into it from outside the system through a telephone line. But there are ways to protect that. However, in the Diebold system, most of the counties who use it do not do the updates, the Windows patches, you know, the ones that say, you know, if you don't put this patch in, anyone can get into your computer and do anything. They don't apply those. And there's quite a few problems with the security at almost every level in these systems. They say it's secure, but every time we've actually gotten hold of the real software, It is Swiss cheese. Walk right in, sit right down, do whatever you want.
Well, whose responsibility is it to see that the software is secure? I mean, is there not some government oversight here?
Not a lot. Actually, and that's really broken down, too, where they have an independent testing authority, supposedly. They call it the ITA. But it turns out that the ITA is paid by the vendors. And our organization, Black Box Voting, is one of the only organizations that has ever gotten an interview with one of the voting machine certifiers. And it turns out they really don't look at it very carefully at all. And he said, and I quote, "I don't like to put anything negative in the report because, of course, the vendors are paying me and they don't want anything negative in there."
I'm afraid we only have time for about the first 15 minutes of that interview. There's a lot more of that. If you want to hear the rest of it, you can go to radioforall.net or americandreamradio.org. Check it out. Now it's time for a recent commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal, U.S. political prisoner.
The American politics of morality. It is utterly amazing to hear mouthpieces for the corporate media sound off about morality issues now driving the American political machine. One wonders, what does morality mean? Does it have anything to do with life and death, with war and peace, with slaughter and genocide? Or does it only have to do with sex? What would a member of the First Peoples, the so-called Indians, say about American morality? A man we now recall by the given name of Powhatan, who was called by his people Wahun Sunnakuk, who was principal chief of a confederacy of 32 tribes, and who ruled over an area of hundreds of miles, was threatened by Captain John Smith with destruction. Chief Powhatan's reply gives us some insight into early American morality. "Why should you take by force that from us which you can have by love? Why should you destroy us who have provided you with food? What can you get by war? We can hide our provisions and fly into the woods, and then you must consequently famish by wronging your friends. What is the cause of your jealousy?" Smith owed his very life to Powhatan's daughter, Pocahontas, who had saved him from execution a year before he threatened her father. Nor was Wahunsonnakuk's rap about the white colonists near starving mere words. Smith himself would write in the General History of Virginia, "So great was our famine that a savage we slew and buried, the poorer sort, took him up again and ate him. And one amongst the rest did kill his wife, powder her, and had eaten part of her." How many Americans know that among their founding fathers were cannibals? Some 200 years later, Americans would force a loyal Indian tribe, the Cherokees, off of their ancestral lands in what has become known as the Trail of Tears. A leader of the Cherokees, a war chief known as Junaluska, had fought with Andrew Jackson in the Battle of the Horseshoe against the Creek. Junaluska brought 500 of his young braves to assist Jackson and save Jackson's life when a Creek warrior had him at his mercy. Junaluska's tomahawk literally saved the man who would later become president. When white colonists in Georgia attacked Cherokee lands and the U.S. government sought to remove them, Junaluska traveled to Washington, D.C. to plead for his tribe. Jackson received him coldly, telling him, "There is nothing I can do for you." Within a short time, over 7,000 army troops and volunteers struck Indian country, and men, women, and suckling babes were forced at bayonet point into stockades where they would be imprisoned until the long walk from Georgia to Oklahoma. Thousands would die of hunger, sickness, fear, and broken hearts on this trail of tears. Junaluska, seeing the way his people, who were called the civilized Indians because of their Christian faith, their European style of building, and their literacy, were treated by Americans, said, "Oh my God, if I had known at the Battle of the Horseshoe what I know now, American history would have been differently written." What do you think they would say about American political morality? What about the long train of coups and counter-coups waged by the U.S. CIA all over the world? There are more dictators, autocrats, tyrants than I have time to name who owe their reins to Washington. They have ravaged their countries, devastated their workers, sold away their souls for their American masters. There is no such thing as political morality. It's an oxymoron, like compassionate conservative or military intelligence. From Death Row, for Free Speech Radio News, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries were produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Next, we're going to hear a talk hosted by Seacoast Peace Response last Tuesday at the UU Church with the Jewish American Medical Project. I understand that a video CD of this talk that's a little bit longer will be available soon if you contact them.
We are really thrilled tonight to have Dr. Alice Rothschild here with us. She's an obstetrician gynecologist at the Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates and at Beth Israel Med Center in Boston. She's worked on issues in women's health care, health politics, and has most recently been focused on peace and justice concerns in Israel and Palestine.
Human Rights Israel was founded by two psychiatrists in 1988, an Israeli and a Palestinian, to respond to what was happening in Gaza at that time. And it has really grown into a very important organization that focuses not only on direct healthcare issues, but also on issues of social justice, and that'll become more clear as we go forward. The UPMRC, which is the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Communities, but I can't say that every single time. So the UPMRC is a grassroots organization, a community based in the West Bank and Gaza, that was started in 1979 by a group of Palestinian healthcare workers who wanted to supplement the decaying medical system in that area of the world. And now it's one of the largest NGOs in the occupied territories, and they provide 40% of the healthcare. And they have multiple community centers, and they serve over 400 communities. Now, my experiences are from the following places. So we arrived in Tel Aviv. We also spent time in Jerusalem, and that's where my experiences in Israel come from. On the West Bank, we went to Ramallah, and then the group split up, and some people stayed in Ramallah, some people went up to Naples here. I went all the way up to Jenin there, and then we came back to Pukam, and Pukam called Papilia, which is right located there. So that's the little circle that we made during the 2 weeks that we were there. And what I want to invite you to do is to basically walk in the shoes of the people that we met. I mean, a lot of what I'm going to talk about is painful, it's difficult to hear, it's conflicting, but unless we do that, we're not going to understand the conflict better. And so I think we're going to start out talking about the West Bank, and then I'm going to go on to my experiences in Israel. Now, one of the first things as a healthcare provider that I'm going to frame this in is the Geneva Convention. And I want you to just think about what I talk about in this context, which is that according to international law, an occupying power needs to let the people who are occupied have their health care. It needs to let health care workers do the work that they need to do. And that's part of international law. And it's just important to keep that as a background. So if you look at what are the conditions like on the West Bank, this was information that we learned while we were there. There are multiple documented cases of medical personnel being killed, injured, ambulances being attacked, patients being unable to get access to health care in ambulances, and medical personnel being injured on the job. So, you know, as a physician, I think, what would you like to worry about whether I'm going to, like, live on the way to work? There have also been multiple episodes of emergency personnel being arrested, hospitals and clinics being attacked, and ultimately people have died because of prevention of access to health care. And a major problem that was being discussed when we were there was the problem of women delivering at checkpoints. It's probably up now to about 100 women, Palestinian women, have delivered at checkpoints because they were refused access across while they were in labor. And a number of them have died in childbirth at checkpoints, basically bleeding to death. And as would be expected, newborns have also died at checkpoints. So there's a tremendous crisis that's going on. And there was a survey done that found that 41% of the women surveyed took longer than 4 hours to get to a hospital. The interesting number here also is that when they looked at healthcare workers, a similar number of people found it took more than 4 hours to get to a hospital. So I kept talking with doctors who would leave their home and not know how long it would take to get to work. And sometimes it was 1 hour, or 2 hours, or 3 hours, or 4 hours, or sometimes they couldn't get there at all. So part of what I began to learn is what the disruption in everyday life was going on there. And it's true of other places, like if you interview students, a huge number of students have trouble getting to school. Now, it's enough of a promise, I said, the women delivering checkpoints, that the UPMRC, along with its, you know, breastfeeding handouts and how to brush your kids' teeth and all the sort of handouts that they do, they have a handout on what do you do if you're in labor at a checkpoint. So that's the level that this has become an issue. In order to understand healthcare on the West Bank, it's really important to get a concept of the checkpoints. Now, the West Bank is a quarter of the size of New Jersey, and there are approximately 750 checkpoints within the West Bank. So that's checkpoints, roadblocks, barriers of any kind. So that we see that there are checkpoints between Israel and the occupied territories, and checkpoints within the occupied territories. And I want to just show you some pictures, because what this means is that any time you leave a village to go to the next village, you have to go through a checkpoint. And this is some of the places we were in, that we were in, and where our checkpoint pictures were taken. And I was a total chicken because I was there by the checkpoints, but some people did take pictures. So this is Colombia. This is how we got in. And just to give you an example, we arrived in Tel Aviv. The THR folks said, you're not going to be able to get into the West Bank. It's been total closure. They're not going to let you in. But you might as well try. So the next day, we schlep over in a cab and get to Colombia. And I walk through. No one stopped me. No one looked at my passport. I just walked in the mud with all my suitcases, you know. And it was a complete letdown. And so you never know whether you're going to be stopped, whether you're not going to get through, you're going to get through. But then I got the sense that this is part of how life is. You never know when you're going to get through a checkpoint. And you can see that this is a checkpoint that there's no traffic. You have to walk through, which means you're 90 years old and with a cane you walk through. You're a young pregnant woman with three little kids, you walk. Everybody has to walk through. This is a checkpoint at Nablus, and you can see this is one where you drive and walk through. And you know, checkpoints are equal opportunity events. So here we have a car, a donkey, and an ambulance. I thought that sort of encompassed the entire society of the West Bank. And basically, you wait. And you wait until an Israeli soldier decides we're not whether to let you through. Sometimes checkpoints are unmanned. This is outside of Kalkilia, and it's just sitting there. And some days it's manned, and some days it's not manned. And that can make a whole difference in your day. This is a checkpoint near Tuparum, and I just want to point out to you that this is a much scarier looking checkpoint, but this big road that looks a lot like highways in California, that's a bypass road, Jewish only for Israeli settlers. I'm standing where the Palestinians are allowed to be, which is a dirt road. And this is a much bigger deal because there's a big Israeli army tower there, plus the guys there at the road there. And this is an example of boulders. You know, the town woke up one day and their road to leave the town was closed by boulders. And sometimes it's ditches. I mean, there's all this kind of stuff. And it's constantly happening, and then the villagers take it away, and then it happens somewhere else. So there's this constant sort of cat and mouse game that goes on. And what you see is young Israeli men, usually 18 to 23, with major, major weaponry. And the thing that really impressed me was, you know, some of these soldiers were bullies. Some of them obviously were scared. Some of them clearly didn't want to be there. Some of them wanted to be there. You know, the whole range of experience you can imagine. But they're heavily, heavily armed. And they are put in what would seem to be an untenable position, because what they're doing is facing down the civilian population. So these are people waiting to get across a checkpoint. And basically, these are civilians. These are women with children. These are men trying to get to work. And they wait. And Palestinians spend a huge amount of their lives just waiting. And they're waiting at the whim of a soldier. And they never know if the soldier's going to say yes or no. And you have to start thinking, what would that be like? Like, I want to go visit my cousin. There were stories of people not being there at their weddings. You can't make appointments. I mean, the level of disruption was just stunning. And you've heard of the separation zone. This is in Abu Dis in East Jerusalem. You can see the wall sort of just coming through. And basically, it just cuts through the neighborhood. So, you know, the brother lives on one side, the sister lives on the other. This is cutting off the university, the two tertiary care level hospitals. Just striking right through the neighborhood. And it evokes images that, for me particularly as a Jew, are totally mortifying. It says, welcome to ghetto Abu Dis. Really takes you back when you see this. So as I said, another part of the group went to Nablus, and I want to just share a little bit about their trip. We had two trips, one in June and one in January, and both times in Nablus they had difficulties getting through checkpoints, And they also bore witness to the fact that the UPMRC clinic had been destroyed by the Israeli Defense Forces. So this was a temporary checkpoint. They had trouble getting in Nablus. Then they were going outside to a little village. They had trouble getting out of Nablus. And this is like in an ambulance with papers, with appointments. The military van is there just stopping them. This is a picture of the clinic. It has been completely trashed by the IDF, and for no reason that they could figure out. And so they had showed us the documentation. And it then got occupied after we left. So this is not a theoretical thing. This happens over and over again. We also found that the office in Ramallah had been occupied after we left. This guy here works for the UPMRC, and he had, there was a curfew, which means you're not allowed to leave your house, but he was responsible for the care of a man with cancer who had open wounds and he was doing dressing care. So clearly identified as a medical personnel, he went with his bag to this man's house. He was arrested, held for 6 days, his family was not told, he was beaten up, he lost all his front teeth, which is why he's not smiling. And then they let him go. This is part of like being a health worker on the West Bank. This is the ambulance graveyard in Nablus. Just ambulances that have been shot at, you know, in various ways and destroyed. And this ambulance took a bullet hole right where he's showing you, and you know, the bullet hit several people in the ambulance. And this is David Young as a healthcare worker on the West Bank.
Morning. A procession of children, like you'd find in any civilized country, were heading to school. We had seen the school briefly when we arrived, gleaming, a modern icon of what was possible with fair aid and commitment to the next generation. As a symbol, it was hard to minimize, and given its location, it was a cruel irony. For just beyond the 6-foot walls protecting the schoolyards was the other wall, this one 26 feet high, staring down at us. This section of the barrier wall bisected the farms next to the school. While the children were inside, our guide Suad was explaining the local situation in Kalkinia.
Whoa, what's happening?
It took a few minutes to regain our composure. We came to Kalkilia, knowing it could be dangerous. There were flashpoints along this imposed boundary constantly. As a captive city, businesses could not survive. Farming was interrupted. And nighttime assaults had left the community shell-shocked. From the roof of an adjacent barn, we could clearly see Israeli settlements on the Palestinian side of the Green Line. Also, the buffer zones, highways, and artillery used to protect and segregate them. A former landfill provided the Israeli army a high embankment used to lob shells into the city. In a city completely encircled by barriers, where farmland had been confiscated, trade routes abruptly barricaded, and families separated. Kalkilia was dying under the strain of the wall. We saw it for ourselves, in the fields, in the streets, at the locked gate. The human costs were incalculable. As the sun went down, we saw what we had only heard about. From inside Kalkilia, the beauty of a sunset had also been taken away by the wall. The symbolism was bad enough. The reality was terrifying.
A couple more pictures. This is Saad's daughter. She's about 10. She's a spunky, bright, vivacious kid. And I kept thinking, here's this articulate, educated, modern mother, and here's her daughter growing up in this town, and what would it be like for her? And she kept running up to the wall and writing Free Palestine with a magic marker. And here she's at the gate that's open at 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. for 1 hour to let the farmers in and out if they have permits and if the soldiers want to do that. And she was making Stars of David and putting X's through them, and at first it just gave me the chills, and I thought, Well, this is very understandable for this kid to feel this way. The only Israelis she sees are the soldiers who shoot in the air when we go by to terrify us. So it was, again, helpful to me to sort of walk in her shoes. And I think it is also useful to, the wall is has been a place for international protest. If you look at the graffiti on the wall, it is extremely painful to look at. But if you imagine living in Kankilia, you can understand why people would put a swastika next to a Jewish star or write Berlin 1953. I mean, it's horrible, but it's also very understandable. And there were also, you know, signs of hope, no wall, peace, and this wall will fall. Everywhere you go, you see soldiers with guns. And so I was trying to understand, what does it mean to have a militarized society? What does it mean when half of the youth go through the military? And it's the guys have their guns in uniform, and also when they're out of uniform, they're walking around with these big guns. And it's a jolting kind of experience, and it means that this is very normative behavior.
And we, Israelis, like a society and leaders, move from how to live, which is a moral question. How do I conduct my life? Is basically a moral question. To the other question, or a very different question, do I live? And for the sake of do I live, I am willing to do many, many things.
We met with a group and learned some information about Israel, which is basically that Israel has a fabulous healthcare system. You know, it's got issues like our healthcare system has issues, but basically in the world of healthcare, it's very, very good. With her kid, these people had not had any healthcare in a year and a half. We were really moved by the fact that some Jewish woman from America would come and listen to what their problems were. And so the problems were, again, the same as I see in the States. But the solutions were very different. This is an older woman who had a breast lump. And it was interesting to me, you know, if I have see someone with a breast lump, they need an ergogram, they need an ultrasound, they need to go to the surgeon. I mean, I know what I'm supposed to do. But here it was, okay, what's the thing she needs most? She needs to see a surgeon. Okay, well, which surgeon is where? How many checkpoints? Who's going to pay? I mean, all these different logistics had to be dealt with to get her breast lump taken care of. And it's unclear whether it would be able to happen. Despite how inadequate the care was that I could do in that setting, it was also very powerful both for the patients and for myself to be able to sort of work across these lines and to be helpful, and also just to bear witness and to listen. Now you've probably heard a lot about the separation wall, and I wanted to show you some pictures here. We went to Kalkilia, and I want to show you why Kalkilia is particularly poignant. This is Israel here, and this is the West Bank. And this little light blue line is the green line, the 67. And Kalkilia has the misfortune of being right up against the green line. And one of the big controversies about the wall is it's not being built on the green line, it's being built in the West Bank. So that the Palestinians who live in these places here can't go to Israel because they can't get across the 67 border. So they can't access services there, they can't get schooling, healthcare, everything. But they can't go this way either because there's a wall. So there are tens of thousands of people now that are going to be in this no man's land between the green line and the wall. Now the thing about Kalkilia here is that this is Israel and this is a bypass road, and this is a main highway, and this is a bypass road to a Jewish settlement, and up there is a bypass road to a Jewish settlement in blue. So the Kalkilia is like a bottle with a neck, and the only way that the people in Kalkilia can get out is through this neck, through the checkpoints. And so they're hemmed in, not only by the wall, but by the bypass roads. And so they've been cut off from their agricultural lands going north and south. And the interesting thing is that if you think the wall is a good idea, Kalkilia is like 10 miles from Tel Aviv, because it is a perfect place for terrorists to just walk across. We need the wall, we need to protect Israelis. But if you look at the history of Kalkilia, it actually has a very peaceful history in Israel. There's a lot of commerce, a lot of workers from Kalkilia work in Israel, a lot of Israelis shopped in Kalkilia for bargains, and there was a huge economy that went on. And now there's about a 70% unemployment rate, and the businesses have closed. The current estimates are that there's a 75% unemployment rate and a 70% absolute poverty, which is less than $2 a day. So what we're seeing is an area where there is basically a major humanitarian crisis going on as far as healthcare goes. And you can see it when you drive through the cities. what happens when homes are bulldozed, where kids are playing, in Janine. And we interviewed several doctors there. And this is Dr. Jamal Al-Hamad. He's the director of UPMRC in Janine. And I began to wonder, where were these guys educated? And it turns out the Palestinian doctors have either been educated in Italy or in some of the Soviet republics. So we were having our interviews in English, Hebrew, Arabic, Russian, and Italian. And it was very wild to see that broad expanse. So he was educated in Minsk, and he had a master's of public health. And he described what it was like to have curfew, because in Janine there had been, in 2003, 50 days of curfew, families being unable to leave their homes. And what he said was, with Oslo there was hope, and most agreed and supported the plans, but nothing happened. There were increasing settlements and land taken. I am not an extremist. I'm a normal person with an open mind. People choose many strategies in international law. This is a right to resist occupation. I'm a doctor. I am resistant. I could leave, make money, not hear a shooting. At that point, it was nighttime and there was shooting going on in the Janine refugee camp, and we could hear it. But this kills the hope and is not solving the problem. So some throw stones, some shooting, some suicide bombers. You need to take the whole picture. I am against killing civilians. But suicide bombing is not the conflict. We have to go to the cause. Why does a young man with a future do this? If there is hope, it will be a decrease in suicide bombing. Other questions yet?
Have you experienced any backlash from the American Jewish community here in where you live in Boston, mm-hmm. Brookline, for speaking out on this issue, either professionally or personally?
So the question is, have I experienced any backlash from the American, from Boston Jewish community? And I would say, yes. I mean, I've had a couple of op-eds in the Globe and gotten like a ton of hate mail. I've had people seemingly be calling me a terrorist. I mean, there are buttons that get pushed when, particularly, I think Jews get up and say, look, you know, Israelis are human, Palestinians are human, people can be victims and victimizers can be in the same body. We need a Truth and Reconciliation Department. I mean, this is not a popular way to present this issue, particularly in the Jewish community. And so one of the reasons I got so involved in the healthcare stuff was I thought, maybe this is a way to talk about it. And I just gave grand rounds at the Lowell Psychiatry Grand Rounds Group. And, you know, I would never be able to talk about this topic if I didn't have healthcare as my... Mm-hmm. It's not cover, but it's my method, you know. Mm-hmm. So I see my responsibility is to try to figure out ways to have this discussion in a civil fashion with other Jews. And it is very, very hard. And part of what I think we as Americans need to understand is, why is it so hard? And why are people so threatened? I mean, there's a much broader range of discussion in Israel than there is in the United States. Mm-hmm. And our little visions group, which I'll tell you is a little group, you know, we would have... we've had the experience of having, you know, a seminar set up at a temple, and then somebody's canceled. And I know that, you know, there's a counselor call, or a camera call, or somebody called to say, eh, no, we can't have those people there. So Jews that speak out do get hassled, and you get backlash, and that's part of the deal. But, you know, if you think it's a, you know, I feel like what I'm doing is actually very Jewish, and that a lot of what I would consider Jewish values have been lost in the creation of the Jewish state. So, you know, we all have our...
When you go back again, what would be your goal?
Well, first of all, my goal is to get in the country. I say that facetiously, but not so facetiously. When we went in as individuals, not as a delegation. And it was partly because a Norwegian medical delegation had been blocked when they kept entering the airport because they were clearly a peace delegation. And so the peacenik types are not welcome. So my first goal is to be able to get into the country and not be on any list that makes them not want to get in. So I think, you know, calling, writing letters, responding to outrageous things, I mean, those are really important things to do. And also, there have been, in the United States, candidates who stood up and said the kind of things that I might say, who then get targeted for an election the next time around. And so it's important to support their candidacies. So, you know, once you get into this, then you get into all the emails that, you know, there's someone running in South Carolina who stood up for the rights of Palestinians and, you know, blah, 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 group is sworn to, you know, fund enough money to make them not get elected. And then so people who disagree with that then send money for their election campaign. I mean, you really got to work with your electoral process. But it's tough.
Right now, we're an occupying nation, so we're having that experience ourselves. It's very different, but I think we're going to learn a lot about occupation. And then, you know, the U.S. Army has asked Israelis to come and teach them how to have a good occupation. So Israelis are in Iraq training our troops, and you can say that that's a really downhill development, you know. One occupation fails, let's try another one. I mean, you know, we need to not be quiet. And, you know, I keep reminding myself, even though Bush won, although 60% of people voted, he got 31%. It still means that almost 70% of people didn't vote for him. So, you know, we got to be out there. We got to be writing letters. We got to be writing letters to the editor. You know, all that kind of stuff is really, really important. And not to be afraid, because this is a really tough topic. But I think if you really get grounded in that every human being is valuable, and we're not going to demonize Arabs, and you know, all the stuff that's going on, you have a starting point.
Gang drove my family from the lands. We ran into the desert, where I've spent these decades living by my hands. Life in Haifa wasn't easy, but so much better than this hellhole with the soldiers and barbed wire and the closures and the hunger, the humiliation and the checkpoints, the machine gun fire. Each day I wonder, after Haifa, the home that we abandoned when the Zionists had won, is there a family with a child? Does its father love it as I loved my only son before the soldiers shot him down, riddled him with bullets in his back and in his head? Home in Haifa, in my house, does his father know the pain there is in an empty bed? I fled my country, left the Tigris River for this foreign place. I had to leave home, I didn't want to, but they were rounding up the leftists and the papers had my face. And my son, a student leader on the streets of Baghdad, was nowhere to be found. So I walked through the mountains, just the shirt upon my back, knowing not where I was bound. Now here I am, this town of Haifa, in this little house, but at least I'm still alive. And each day I wonder, how is Baghdad? Would I recognize my friends if any did indeed survive? It took a long time, but I made a life here, and I wish my son could be here in this town upon the shore. I was with my wife, it was the Sabbath, when an old Arab couple knocked upon our door. We asked them in, gave them tea, 'cause that's what you do with strangers. We could see they meant no harm. We told our story, they told theirs. Us of our life in Baghdad, them of their family farm, and of this house which they once lived in, where once they raised a family long before their hair turned gray, and of their son and the troopers, and of ours, whom we still cry for every day. So much in common, so much gone bad, so much running and never coming home. You can hear the cars falling down, see the faces of the children forever forced to roam. And here we were in this house, fearing that tomorrow would be just like yesterday. So much resentment, so much at stake, and I really don't remember who was the first to say, in one world, in one one home. Let us live together in one world, in one village, in one home. Let us live together in one world, in one village, in one home. Let us live together in one world.
That was Dave Rovix with In One World. One of the Palestinians interviewed by the Jewish American Medical Project that you just heard was Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. You can visit the website vopj.org to hear this fascinating interview about his work with the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Committees and in creating a democratic, nonviolent movement in Palestine. We have also just learned that Dr. Barghouti, who is a distant cousin of the much-publicized Marwan Barghouti, is running in the Palestinian presidential race. The following piece by Genevieve Cora Frazier updates us on this new development. Israel attempts to derail Mustafa Barghouti's candidacy for president of Palestine. The Palestinian presidential candidate I'm rooting for is Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, a distant cousin to the jailed Fatah leader Marwan Barghouti. He co-founded the Palestinian National Initiative with the late Edward Said as a democratic opposition movement to the Fatah-dominated Palestinian administration and the Legislative Council, which appointed approximately 6,000 municipal representatives rather than have them elected by the people. Barghouti believes that a sovereign, independent, viable, and democratic Palestinian state must be built upon the institutional framework of the Palestinian civil society, a nonviolent, self-reliant, self-determined network of NGOs, or non-governmental organizations, that include educational, medical, cultural, and charitable organizations, as well as research institutes, plus environmental and legal organizations, to name a few. The Palestinian civil society was developed after the failure of the Camp David peace talks in 1978. It was then that Palestinians came to realize that help would not be found from outside their borders, but from within, Dr. Barghouti stated. In addition to serving as Secretary General to the Palestinian National Initiative, Dr. Barghouti is the president of the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Committees, providing health and community services to more than 1 million people. But unfortunately, there's a problem with Dr. Barghouti's candidacy. The Israeli government seems bent on making him a non-viable candidate. The Israeli military recently prevented his campaigning in Hebron by holding him at a checkpoint at gunpoint. Most recently, Barghouti was beaten to the ground and repeatedly assaulted as he attempted to intervene while the military beat his staff with the butt of their rifles. As I write this, Dr. Barghouti is in a hospital outside of Jenin, recovering from Israeli Defense Force-induced injuries. Here's another date to keep in mind. On December 8, 2000, the Cochabamba, Bolivia, declaration asserting water as a fundamental right and public trust not to be commodified, privatized, or traded for commercial purposes was issued by citizens of Bolivia, Brazil, Canada, India, and the U.S. When in April 2000 a subsidiary of Bechtel took over water delivery services in Bolivia, water rates rose so high the poor were spending a major part of their income on water. The people rebelled, mounting an uprising, and won. Here is their declaration. We, citizens of Bolivia, Canada, United States, India, and Brazil, farmers, workers, indigenous people, students, professionals, environmentalists, educators, non-governmental organizations, retired people, gathered together today in solidarity to combine forces in the defense of the vital right to water. Here, in this city, which has been an inspiration to the world for its retaking of that right through civil action, courage and sacrifice, standing as heroes and heroines against corporate, institutional, and governmental abuse, and trade agreements which destroy that right, in use of our freedom and dignity, we declare the following. For the right to life, for the respect of nature and the uses and traditions of our ancestors and our peoples, for all time, the following shall be declared as inviolable rights with regard to the uses of water given us by the earth. 1. Water belongs to the earth and all species, and is sacred to life. Therefore, the world's water must be conserved, reclaimed, and protected for all future generations, and its natural patterns respected. 2. Water is a fundamental human right and a public trust to be guarded by all levels of government. Therefore, it should not be commodified, privatized, or traded for commercial purposes. These rights must be enshrined at all levels of government. In particular, an international treaty must ensure these principles are non-controvertible. Water is best protected by local communities and citizens who must be respected as equal partners with the government in the protection and regulation of water. Peoples of the Earth are the only vehicle to promote Earth democracy and save water. To get involved with local efforts to protect New Hampshire's water, please see www.saveourgroundwater.org. And we're getting to the end of the show here. Just want to end with some words by Robert Jensen about A Defeat for an Empire. It was published on December 9th, 2004 by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. He said, "The most courageous act of citizenship in the United States today is pledging to dismantle the American Empire. An anti-empire movement, the joining of anti-war forces with the movement to reject corporate globalization, must create that pressure." Well, we're running out of time on today's Making Waves show. If you would like to comment or ask about any of the music or otherwise contact us, you can write an email to nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com. And we'll close the program with a little bit of music, so stay tuned.
Here's a song by Jay Unger and Molly Mason as we enter the holiday buying season.
Things are crazy in this country of ours. Everybody's selling something, from diet pills to cars, all guaranteed to make us happier than we are. But I ain't gonna buy it. We used to be the land of the free. Now we're the land of 700 channels on TV, and on each one's a commercial aimed at me. But I ain't gonna buy it. I'm tired of people trying to sell me stuff. Don't they know that I've already got enough? No matter how you flaunt it, I'm never gonna want it. So I ain't gonna buy it. Boarded and TV'd about all the things I'm missing, all the things I really need. Well, it's just one great big load of corporate greed. And I ain't gonna buy it. We've all heard that it pays to advertise, even if those ads are all a pack of lies. It took me many years, but I got wise. And I ain't gonna buy it. I'm tired of people trying to sell me stuff. Don't they know that I've already got enough? My bank account is low, my closet's full and so I ain't gonna buy it.
You know, marketing used to be something that everybody did. They took a basket and went to the store and got what they needed. Now, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, just about the only one this country has left. And consumption used to be a disease. It still is.
Next time you find yourself at the mall, at a great big sale for Christmas, or summer, spring, or fall, just remember, you already got it all. And say, I ain't gonna buy it. And now they're trying to sell me a war, one that's quick and clean and safe, as long as you're not brown or poor. But I can't quite figure out just what it's for. So I ain't gonna buy it. And I'm tired of politicians talking tough. Don't they know that I've already heard enough? No matter how they spin it, I don't trust it for a minute. And I ain't gonna buy it. I'm sick of all this selling, and brother, hear me yelling. ain't gonna buy it.
And finally, we're going to have an a cappella piece by Charlie King and Karen Brando called The 12 Days of Invasion. Talking about a country that might sound a little bit familiar.
On the first day of invasion, my leader said to me, they're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the second day's invasion, my leader said to me, they have weapons of mass destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world. On the third day of invasion, my leader said to me, they won't allow inspections.
Weapons of destruction,
they're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the fourth day of invasion, my leader said to me, they didn't sign the biological weapons treaty.
Won't allow inspections.
Weapons of destruction,
they're the most dangerous nation in the world. On the fifth day of invasion, my leader said to me, demand regime change now. Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections,
weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the sixth day of invasion, my leader said to me, all they want is oil.
Demand regime change now. Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections,
weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world. On the seventh day's invasion, my leader said to me, they just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now. Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections,
weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the eighth day of invasion, my leader said to me, they execute their people.
They just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now. Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections,
weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world. On the ninth day of invasion, my leader said to me, they helped to train Al-Qaeda.
Execute their people.
They just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now. Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections,
weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the tenth day of invasion, my leader said to me, they have invaded other countries.
Help to train Al-Qaeda.
Execute their people.
They just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now. Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections,
weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world. On the 11th day's invasion, my leader said to me, they were not fairly elected.
Invaded other countries.
Help to train Al-Qaeda.
Execute their people.
They just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now. Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections,
weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the 12th day of invasion, my leader said to me, they plan to use the bomb.
Not fairly elected.
Invaded other countries.
Helped to train Al-Qaeda.
Execute their people.
They just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now.
Didn't sign the treaty,
won't allow inspections,
weapons of destruction.
And they're the most dangerous nation in the world.